History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The Gilded Age was all about people who climbed from the lowest rung of society and became incredibly wealthy, the equivalent of today's billionaires. Andrew Carnegie was a Scottish immigrant who moved to a poverty-ridden area outside of Pittsburgh, began working at the age of 13 in a textile factory, then worked to set up a military telegraph system with the federal government, and then ended his career selling bonds in England and the U.S. for railroads and other businesses. John Rockefeller was the son of a literal snake oil salesman and bigamist, who became fantastically wealthy in the oil trade and possibly the world's first billionaire. But perhaps nobody climbed the social ladder more aggressively than Cassie Chadwick. Chadwick was a drifter from Canada who set herself up as the wife of a rich doctor in Cleveland before moving on to a much bigger con involving the richest man in the world, Carnegie himself. With little education, no financial training, and at a time when women didn't even have the right to vote, Chadwick was born Elizabeth Bigley, moved up the chain of bankers, getting each banker to loan her more than the one before, telling a simple lie, that she was the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie, and she was due to inherit his entire fortune. Using only the powers of manipulation and her charisma, she was able to convince bankers to give her lines of credit worth millions. By the time the police caught up to her, she'd wrecked the banking system of Cleveland, sending one unfortunate banker to his grave and causing the collapse of another major bank. When the trial was held, it was a media event that pushed the trial of Teddy Roosevelt off the front pages with a climactic moment when Carnegie appeared to face his accuser in court. Cassie was eventually convicted, but not before taking others with her and leaving a legacy as the biggest con woman in the United States, only to be eclipsed by Charles Ponzi. To talk about the story, I'm joined with frequent guest Bill Hazelgrove, and he's the author of the new book, Greed in the Gilded Age, The Brilliant Con of Cassie Chadwick. So we look at the excesses of the Gilded Age, why it was possible for someone like Chadwick to be able to convince so many people she was who she wasn't, how she was able to manipulate the rules of decorum and acting properly, which coexisted with the Gilded Age's social fluidity that allowed newcomers to enter the scene, and how her scandal was the trial of the century, but it says a lot about the time period in which she lived and how a lot of luck and determination can get you very far. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with Bill Hazelgrove. Bill, welcome back to the show once again. I think I've lost count. Is this the fourth time, fifth time? It's been quite a few.
Yeah, fourth or fifth. I know these books just keep coming.
Yeah, been cranking them out and covered a bunch of different people, different figures. And, you know, some we celebrate, Teddy Roosevelt. Others are, we celebrate for different reasons, like Sally Rand.
Right.
But we're going to look at somebody else that you cover in your book that, if nothing else, we have to respect her ability for improvisation and being able to read the room, being able to play on people's insecurities or whatever you would call it, a very effective con artist. So yes. Before getting too far into the story of Cassie Chadwick, what we're going to look at is the Gilded Age and one particularly effective con artist. And I wonder what it is about the Gilded Age that makes your story make sense. Con artists are a time-honored tradition in the United States, from land speculators and sellers in the colonial and early periods to the miracle cure and nerve tonic salesmen of the antebellum period. But it seems that the cons in the Gilded Age get bigger. So what's going on in this time period that explains the rise of somebody like Cassie Chadwick?
Well, you know, the Gilded Age, as you know, was coined by Mark Twain in his book, The Gilded Age. And basically, it refers to the metaphor of a gold patina over rotting wood underneath. And that's how Twain saw this era, a massive, massive growth, really industrialization of America after the Civil War. I was sort of ranging from 1865 all the way up to the Titanic sinking, which are really convenient benchmarks. But, you know, all those tracks that they laid during the Civil War allowed, you know, this great market, this national market to evolve, where suddenly you weren't selling your goods in your small town. You weren't going down to the town square to sell your corn or whatever, but it's being shipped off to New York or to the West Coast, to these big national markets. And at the same time, you know, people were beginning to leave the farms. We're moving to a more urban society. And this massive industrialization gave people the opportunity to sell their time for wages. So the wage slave was born. And this is a new concept. I mean, before people would labor for their own good, now people are laboring for somebody else. And they're doing this in massive, massive numbers. And suddenly this class of people, we call them robber barons today, evolved in America, this moneyed class that had wealth that nobody had seen before. And, you know, this is really the underlying goal of the Gilded Age was this moneyed class. And, you know, as we've discussed before, it was very small segment of society, but it was new. And so in this sort of cauldron of greed and money steps this young woman from Canada, this drifter, really, and she goes to stay in Cleveland. And she sees the sidewalks lined with gold. And everybody was sort of infected with this idea that, you know, millionaire had just been coined as a term. Conspicuous consumption had just been coined as a term. So people did believe, at least in the press and in the culture, that, you know, there was a pot of gold over the next hill. So I think this allowed for a sort of put on hold the morals, the mores of the time, and go for it. And into this steps this woman, Cassie Chadwick.
We'll return later on to say what her success, quote unquote success, says about this time period, if she's just merely playing the game more effectively than others, Kim Kardashian of her time period. But right. Let's talk about her origin story. And you mentioned that she was a drifter from Canada. How does she arrive in Cleveland? And what is her first con that I suppose we could say establishes her?
Right. Okay. So her father works for the railroad. Cassie Chadwick is, or rather her real name is Elizabeth Bigley, is this, you know, young woman who's pretty bright, and she has these strange spells at times people talk about where she just doesn't talk. Well, one day she takes an old dress of her mother's, some old shoes, fashions a hat, puts on some makeup, and she has a little card made up saying she's going to inherit, I think it was $15,000 from a rich aunt. And she goes into town and goes to a bank. And this is at a time when money was lent on perceived wealth. You know, today we go through credit checks and all sorts of things to get money. Well, that was not the case in the late 19th century in banking. Really, bankers had a lot of power to just sort of lend on the spot. They thought you were wealthy. And so, you know, she's a well-developed young woman. She's pretty. She understands sort of how to use that. She speaks with a lisp. She has a low voice. Men have to sort of lean in to listen to her. So she immediately goes to these bankers, presents her card. They sort of bring in other bankers, and she walks out with a credit line, basically checks. And so she goes on a spree, goes to restaurants, goes to hotels, you know, really sort of lives it up. And by the time they catch up with her, she's put, you know, she's pasted these bad checks all over town, and she's dragged into court where she acts insane. You know, one can make a case, maybe she was, but pretty much it was an act. And then the court says, basically, you know, we're going to let you off, but we think you should go. You know, we don't want you in this town anymore. So she's shipped off to her sister in Cleveland and her husband, who had made a life in America. And this is, to Elizabeth Bigley, this is great. Because again, America to her was this place just lined with money. And not just to her, but to everyone. I mean, the press in America was a place of freedom and, you know, untold riches and untold opportunities. So this is how she ends up in Cleveland.
From here, is it simply moving from one mark to another? Based on press accounts, have you read, is there any sort of master plan, or does she just move tactically from position to position once she arrives in Cleveland?
So she arrives in Cleveland, and, you know, again, this is a short on probation, but she's staying with her sister. Her sister is married and living sort of this domestic middle-class life. And actually, she begins to be a dressmaker, but she really doesn't like this. And so quickly, she does the same thing. She dresses up, has her little card, has a letter made up, and she starts going to the local banks and drawing out money, getting loans again. And again, this is a time when people expected kickbacks as bankers. Say somebody would give somebody $5,000 on $50,000 and exorbitant interest rates. But for her purposes, she didn't care. So, you know, she's doing this on unsecured loans, but then they say, well, we need collateral. And so she offers her sister's furniture as collateral. This goes on for a while, but of course she can't pay the loans back. Men arrive at her sister's house. Her husband's there to take their furniture. And, you know, her Cassie's sister's husband is outraged and he throws her out the door. So now she's on her own, essentially, in Cleveland.
From here, her con is that she links herself to perhaps the most powerful man in the United States at the time. Where does this fake connection that she has with him come from? How is it hatched? And it seems like a strange tactic, but do you think it was a good idea?
Well, all right. So I'm going to fill in the gap between these two because this sort of informs it. For a brief stint, she becomes Madame de Vere, which is, you know, the Gilded Age was a time of immense change. People felt religion was falling back. Science was moving in. And people, you know, had questions. And so these spiritualists were in vogue and people could come and talk to the dead. Well, this is what she did. And there's sort of overtones of other things going on, maybe a little bit of the brothel. We aren't sure. But then she actually does marry. She finds a farmer to marry and has a son. And then she pulls a con where she actually gets tripped up by the law. And she ends up getting sentenced to 11 years in prison. And this is a con of basically forgery. She only serves 3 years, but during this time, she really comes to hate the men who put her in jail. And so when she comes back from this, she changes her name again, and she meets a guy named Dr. Chadwick. And Dr. Chadwick is she actually has the equivalent of a massage parlor at this point. And Dr. Chadwick has rheumatism. He's a renowned doctor. He's wealthy. He lives on what's called Millionaire's Row. And so he marries her. He's very taken with her. Again, she says she's a rich heiress from Ireland, and they get married and she settles in. And it's at this point she hatches her brilliant con, if you will, of saying that she is the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie. So how do you do something like this? How would you do something like this? Well, the first thing you would do is you would find the most powerful people in finance to pass this information to. And so what Cassie does is she goes to New York and she meets a guy named James Dillon, who's a lawyer. And she says, will you give me a ride to my father's house? And he says, sure. And they go to Fifth Avenue and stop in front of the Carnegie Mansion. And, you know, Dillon's jaw just drops. He can't believe that this is her father. And she goes, could you wait here for a minute? And he's, of course. And so she goes in and she talks to the maid about nothing for a while, just to kill time inside the Carnegie Mansion. She comes back out and drops an envelope, this envelope of documents at her feet. And in it is this trust, basically saying that she's going to inherit the Carnegie millions. And she says, listen, I got to tell you a deep, dark secret. You can tell nobody. And she tells him that Carnegie's her father and that she has been paid for years and that she will inherit the entire Carnegie fortune. And she tells Dillon, who's a financial lawyer in New York, don't tell anybody. Well, of course, Dillon goes and tells everybody. And so this is the beginning of this great con. Is she starts to get in the back channels of the financial world this knowledge that this woman is going to inherit the Carnegie millions. And so it is this, at this point, you know, it's an evolving con. So she then goes to a guy named Ira Reynolds. And Ira Reynolds has a large bank, the Wade Park Bank. And basically she comes up to him with a little package and says, listen, I need to tell you something. And so she tells him the story of Carnegie and says, in this little package is $5 million worth of securities. And she says she wants to keep it, but she wants a note worth that value. Well, Reynolds looks at the package. It's all sealed up. And he says, well, maybe I should look inside it. And she says, do you doubt my word? And this is at a time, and this is sort of part of her con. This is a time where decorum is very ironclad, and there's very ironclad rules between how you react, how you interact with a lady, especially a lady of wealth. And so Reynolds says, of course, I don't doubt your word. That's fine. And he doesn't open the package and gives her a note for $5 million. Now, Cassie is very adept at sort of using the game of checkers and getting loans. She goes from one bank to another using that other bank. So now when she goes to a guy named Eaton, who's a pastor, who basically, you know, is sort of a pastor to the wealthy, and says, listen, I have a dark secret to tell you, as she tells him, again, the story of being, you know, the daughter of Andrew Carnegie. Can you, you know, tell me where I might put my money and, you know, get me into some other circles? And so Eaton passes her on to more bankers, more people of wealth, who and she pulls money from and says, if you doubt me, look what I have. I have this line of credit from the Wade Park Bank for $5 million. And they say, oh, well, she's good for it. And then they give her more. So she's very adept at sort of using the bankers against each other.
Right. This seems like a Ponzi scheme of lines of credit that she'll just keep building and going and going higher on this house of cards, not to mix my metaphors too much, but is the idea to keep going to get as much as she can possibly extract and then leave town before the lie comes crashing down?
You know, that's a great question, because what is really the driving force here? One is she does use that method of just moving on. And this is at a time also where you can change your name and there's no social security number. So she could, you know, leave, change your name, and nobody would know. Now, but she is Miss Chadwick now, Dr. Chadwick's wife. And where, you know, a lot of this drive to have immense wealth. And, you know, she buys 8 great grand pianos. She has 2 cars. She has servants. She has jewelry worth $100,000. She has clothes. She redoes Dr. Chadwick's house, you know, 1, 2, 3 times. And she invites the royalty of Millionaire's Row to her house. And not going too far afield, this is really the basic plot of the HBO series, The Gilded Age, where new money comes to old money. So the old money comes in to Cassie Chadwick's ballroom, if you will, of her mansion. And they're aghast. You know, conspicuous consumption doesn't describe everything that's crammed into this house now that Cassie's been buying. And the impressions of her are she's a little insane, that she's there's a strange glint in her eyes, and she has broken English. You know, she speaks incorrectly. And Cassie, we start to get a glimmer of one of the things that she's trying to do is to sort of buy off her old personality, buy off who she was, and become this new opulent Cassie Chadwick. And by doing so, she believes that if, the more she buys, the more money she has, the more she's insured to be this person. Of course, it works in the reverse. Everybody sort of recoils from her. And by the way, nobody ever comes back to, you know, the Chadwick home after this, because they can sniff this imposter, you know, this sort of person who's parading as this opulently wealthy woman, but there's something not quite right. And so I do think that this is what's driving her. And then she's moving around as much as she can to always stay one step ahead of the bankers.
I mean, it seems like on the one hand, she's able to find holes in the social fabric, that society is fluid enough that newcomers can come in. There's new money. People who aren't as well established can find a seat at the table, yet there's still this old rule of decorum that you mentioned, that if somebody were brazen enough to challenge someone on their honor and others simply didn't want to call them out on it, they could get away with quite a bit, as she did. But there's a number of figures that come to mind as she's going about. I mean, there's a Great Gatsby trying to reinvent yourself. I also thought of Elizabeth Holmes from Theranos, trying to fake it until you make it. Have technology that doesn't work, but hope I'm just going to keep writing this as long as I can until, I don't know, maybe it eventually comes true. Maybe I simply do have status because I've had this fake status for so long, it becomes real. Not likely she's operating at that high of a level or thinking through that much, but what's the best explanation you could come up with from how she's rationalizing all of these moves to herself? Or is she?
I think, honestly, Scott, she might be a bit of a sociopath in terms of she doesn't seem to register in a basic way that this is wrong at all. Even when she was very young and perpetrating these cons, there is no sign of remorse or that what she's doing is wrong. When she married another gentleman before Chadwick, and before she, on their wedding night, again, people bust into their house saying she owes money. And she's told this guy that, you know what, I'm an heiress. And of course, he gets a detective to really give him the lowdown, and he finds out she's an imposter, divorces her. She goes on the road then and uses his name to the tune of about $6,000 and to rack up, you know, restaurants, hotels, clothes, until they catch up with, they contact her husband and say, is she's doing all this in your name? And he says, I'm not her husband anymore. But, you know, again, she just keeps going. And, you know, in all the research I did, I never found any sort of recognition that what she's doing is wrong, which I think is probably the true sign of someone who doesn't recognize, say, the moral order of the world. You know, not to go off left field again, there's another show out called Inventing Anna. Now it's number one on Netflix. And it's this. It's a modern day Cassie where this woman, Anna Sarkin, pawns herself off as a New York socialite and tells everybody her father is wealthy and she's going to pay off everybody. And she lives on everybody else. And she does this for a long time and creates this persona. And she seems to, this woman seems to have no perception that what she's doing is wrong. In fact, she believes that because she's got a photographic memory and she's smart, that she doesn't play on the same field as others. Now, Cassie Chadwick, I'm not going to say she has a photographic memory, but the trust documents that she comes up with and will later surface in court, and by the way, that's the trial of the century, we can talk about that, are very, very complicated. I mean, these are trusts that lawyers and the top men of finance examined and said, oh yeah, this is valid. So for her to understand, these complicated legal vehicles, and the legalese used in these documents, shows someone who has a pretty high intellect. But after that, I think she was a straight-out sociopath.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Before she's caught by the police, she's running this sort of Ponzi scheme, I guess, where lines of credit substantiate larger lines of credit. And the thing about a Ponzi scheme is that it does work for a little while. The very first people who get in, other people who come in later, pay for their so-called earnings, and then they tell other people, and then there's organic growth to this original Ponzi scheme. But because there's no actual investment growth taking place, eventually the money runs out, and you can only rob Peter to pay Paul so many times before the whole thing collapses. So how long does this go on, and what sort of damage is left in her wake with banks or bankers or others? What kind of damage does she cause when she's having this, opulent jewelry rocket ride?
Yeah, that's a good term. Yeah, so she runs about 5 to 6 years, just pulling these loans and living this lifestyle. And by the way, her husband realized something's not right and has retreated to Europe with his daughter and has a secret plan to leave Cassie. But Cassie doesn't care. Because she is riding the wave and just living this incredible life. Now, what is her Achilles heel? It's the Oberlin Bank. A guy named Beckworth runs it. Now, Beckworth is the opposite of Cassie Chadwick. He's a staid 19th century banker with a mustache. He walks the town with a cane every day. He knows all the people of the town. And he's a very successful banker who kind of has a hands-on approach. So he's lived, he has a wife and children. He's lived this very staid late 19th century life. Well, in comes Cassie Chadwick into his bank on one night, and he sits down with her with a guy named Spears, who was basically a teller at the bank. And she tells him this fantastic story of being the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie. And she needs a bank to park her millions because it's coming. It's coming. And she shows him this trust agreement showing that she will inherit millions and millions and millions of dollars. And that she wants to give it to the Oberlin Bank, which is a small bank. Beckworth is just blown away. And then she shows him the line of credit from the Wade Park Bank for $5 million. And he can't believe it. This is true. And he sees just, you know, this incredible pot of gold that, you know, he's going to become wealthy. The bank's going to do great. And she says, listen, I just need some money to tide me over before, you know, I inherit all this money. And so she takes a small loan right away, maybe $10,000. And she pays it back right away. As you said, in a Ponzi scheme, you take money from one person, pay the other, making them think it's coming from an investment or something like that. That's what Cassie's been doing. She's been taking money from one bank, paying another bank, just enough to kind of keep everything together. So she pays it back right away. And Beckworth is just like, well, this is great. And she says, well, you know, this time I'm going to need $50,000. And again, he pays her back pretty quickly. Well, now she's off to the races. And basically, she cleans out the bank. The bank probably has $500,000 in deposits. And then Beckworth starts to lend her his own money to the tune of $100,000. And this is all predicated. I mean, we were talking about the Gilded Age before. 19th century people were not prepared for this juggernaut of just money, industrialization, this transformation of society from this religious, this sort of religion-based society of the 19th century to this more science, money-driven society that had just come in overnight. And so Beckworth is caught up in it. And he believes she is who she says she is. Well, when the whole thing blows up because a guy named Newton gave her a loan for $190,000 that she could not pay back. And Newton was a New York banker. And so he wasn't Beckworth. He did a quick investigation, found out she was a fraud and sued her. Well, the whole thing starts to unravel. And the Oberlin Bank defaults because suddenly Beckworth realizes that, you know, all the depositors' money's gone. And this is a time when there's no FDIC. You know, today, you and I, we put money in a bank. If there's a run on it, we can get $100,000 at least to insure our account. There is none of that. So what happens? It's like that great scene in It's a Wonderful Life. There's a run on the bank. And all these investors and these people, their savings accounts and farmers all run in and take what's left and there's nothing left. And so all these people lose all their money. And this is really why the government went after Cassie Chadwick. They really couldn't give a damn what she was doing up till now. But now people, normal middle-class people, lower middle-class people have lost their money and somebody's got to be brought to pay for this. And they go after Cassie Chadwick. And really what the government does is they don't care about all these millions of dollars, you know. This trial, just to set it up for the listeners, is going to be the trial of the century. And when I was looking through the newspaper articles, this eclipsed Teddy Roosevelt's inauguration. It was front page news just day after day after day. So what does the government do? They go after her for conspiracy to defraud a bank, basically passing bad checks, you know, because that's what they can get her on. And all they do is they prove that she was pulling checks with Beckworth and Spears, and they pulled them into it, saying they were in conspiracy with her, which they were not. They were just duped. And that's the crime that they're going to convict her on, is conspiracy. Now, Beckworth is so broken, so devastated by this, he dies before she comes to trial. And, you know, in the papers, it's all, he died of just basically shame, you know, and it does seem that's what happened because he was healthy up to then, and then he just was devastated. So when the trial of the century opens, and by the way, you know, in the book, there's a whole chase scene where the Treasury agents and everybody in Secret Service are trying to get Cassie in New York and chasing her from hotel to hotel. And there's a a great scene that shows the decorum of the early 20th century where the marshals finally catch up with her in a hotel, in a very opulent hotel, and she's in bed. And this big burly sheriff comes in and says, "Madam, I have an unpleasant duty to perform. I have to tell you, you're under arrest." And she says, "But I am ill. What can I do?" And he says, "Well, this is very unpleasant, so I will wait outside until you feel better, and then we can conduct business." So it's none of this battering ram stuff we have today where people break in doors and stuff like that. Because again, women were not arrested for embezzling millions of dollars. This was just unheard of. So now we're facing the trial of the century.
Before we get into the trial, I'm curious, what happens to not just the Oberlin Bank, which, as you mentioned, there's a run on it, but does this set off a domino effect in Cleveland where the banking system goes down? And what are the ripple effects that her shenanigans in Ohio cause?
Yeah, actually, the banking system takes a huge blow from this, and bankers all go to New York, where Cassie's under guard, and they parade into her room while she's laying in bed, talking to her, trying to see if they're going to get paid at all. And of course, they're not. And so what happens? A lot of them eat it. They just hide it. Because to say they were part of this Cassie Chadwick con would create a run on their banks. So these banks, you know, take big hits. They don't collapse, but, you know, they lose, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And a lot of them just hide it. Because to say that they were part of this con would create panic. And, you know, the Oberlin Bank, which is taken over by the government, you know, is sort of the poster child of, okay, this is what can happen to you if you're part of this Cassie Chadwick con. And, you know, this goes all the way up to the president, where Roosevelt actually gets briefed on this. And he says in a statement, you know, this Gilded Age is basically out of control. This run for money where even women are doing untoward things, you know. And so while the banking system held together in Cleveland, it was tottering because nobody wanted to be tagged with being stupid enough to lend her this money. And by the way, a lot of bankers, especially this guy Newton, who gave her $190,000, believed that Cassie Chadwick was merely a front and that there was a man behind it. And that was because nobody could believe a woman was smart enough to get this money and that a man must have come up with this con.
When we get to the trial, I mean, this has sensationalism all over it. The claim that she's the illegitimate child of Andrew Carnegie, one of the wealthiest men in the world at the time. What did the press make of it? What's her defense? And then what happens when Andrew Carnegie enters the scene?
Yeah, well, so you're right. First of all, the press is speculating that this might be true. That, well, you know, maybe this woman really was the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie. And they put the trust agreement that she had created all over the front pages. And so Carnegie is interviewed. And, you know, Carnegie's an interesting, in the book, as you know, I sort of run parallel tracks between Carnegie and Cassie Chadwick. Carnegie's an interesting guy because, you know, soon after he had made millions, and Carnegie, by the way, did not believe in hard work. You know, we're always told work hard and you get maybe what you want. Carnegie didn't believe in that. He only worked like 4 hours a day and then he didn't work at all. But he didn't understand why he should have so much when others had so little. So he took some years off and he did research and read deeply and came up with a book called Wealth. And in the book, his thesis was that, you know, it's not due to hard work that someone could become rich like I did. It's really more serendipitous. It's really being at the right place at the right time. And in his case, the United States was expanding. The railroads were expanding, and he happened to be manufacturing steel for all the rail lines. And so this made him fabulously wealthy. And he said, you became wealthy because of all the other people working for you and the markets and such. But it wasn't that you had some special talent. It was more just Providence smiled on you and gave you this money. So, you know, he's regarded as a god in society. And, you know, he's only 5 foot tall. I think he's actually 4'11". And he has a white beard and this little gnome-like head. He looks like a little short Santa Claus. And so, you know, when they catch up with him and tell him about this, he says that that's absurd. You know, I haven't put my signature to a line of credit or anything like that for 30 years. But as they question him, he asks the reporter, he says, "You don't think people actually believe her, do you?" And the reporter says, "Well, she says it's true. And, you know, they're waiting to hear from you." So first he says he's not going to go to the trial. But then I think curiosity took hold of him, because Carnegie understood, I mean, beyond his book Wealth, he was a ruthless man. I mean, the Homestead strikes prove it, where he had people gunned down with Pinkertons. And so I think he was very curious about this woman who had managed to get the equivalent of, say, and by the way, the numbers range all over the place. I took it to $2 million in 1906 dollars, which today is like $60 million. But this woman had managed to do what most people had not. She had accrued incredible wealth. So Carnegie travels to Cleveland to the trial, and it's the trial of the century. And, you know, he's blinded with all this flash powder coming in, and he comes into the courtroom, and, you know, it's loaded with reporters. So there's great accounts of this. And he crosses the room. Cassie Chadwick is just sitting there looking kind of bored, doesn't even change her position when he comes in. And he sits down and he looks at Cassie Chadwick. And Chadwick, again, just sort of staring off the space. And then she slowly turns toward him and stares him dead in the eye. And Carnegie just feels like a chill goes through him, because he's staring at this woman, and he's in all the things he was looking for, you know, answers to why one person ends up with all these millions and somebody else doesn't, is right there. Because he just sees this ruthless creature in front of him who will do anything. And suddenly to Carnegie, this epiphanic moment hits where he goes, "That bitch is me. That bitch is me." And so, you know, this is the moment. This is the big moment of the trial where these two face each other down.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. You know, I think I have to give Carnegie a lot of credit, because I was thinking that as well, that he is a poor Scottish immigrant to America who is, you know, despite his discussion of luck, which I think is true in many ways, also comes to his wealth through incredible determination and hard work, similar to a John Rockefeller, who works as a lowly bookkeeper, is incredibly diligent, incredibly hardworking, comes into the trades in Ohio, comes into the oil industry through skill, luck, determination, and a number of other factors, becomes extravagantly wealthy. But in many ways, what they're seeing, and as you pointed out, Chadwick, she perhaps, her cards that she was dealt weren't as good, but also relies on determination, presenting herself in a certain way, and luck. So that's very interesting. I mean, do you agree with Carnegie's assessment that they're really very similar? They're cut from the same cloth, except circumstances ended up being slightly different for the two of them?
I do, in the fact that, you know, ruthless determination is something that is bestowed in some people and in others it is not. The ability to say, "I will do whatever it takes." Now, Carnegie, for all his writing about wealth and all sort of Darwinism that he ended up with at the end of Wealth, saying that, in fact, I was bestowed with this money and it's my job to give it to the less disenfranchised, he was ruthless. And when he first came over and was, you know, working the telegraphs and all that in the for the railroads and working his way up, he also, though, was privy to inside stock information from these very telegraphs. And he used that to get basically inside traded stocks. And he did things that today would be illegal. And he even wrote about this and said, you know, this might be criminal today, when he was writing his autobiography looking back. But he understood at that point that, you know, collusion was a very powerful tool. And so he started to collude with other men who had inside information. And he was amazed that he would get a stock dividend for doing nothing. Nothing at all. And that's when he came to believe that wealth had little to do with hard work, that it was something else. And maybe it's this determination. So here you have this Scottish immigrant, this Canadian immigrant, if you will. She comes to America. Both see a wide open market. One is, you know, of the landed class, white male. Another is a second class citizen, no education, a woman at a time when women were totally disenfranchised. Yet they both climb these hills, and, you know, Cassie ends up on Millionaire's Row, and Andrew Carnegie has a massive mansion on Fifth Avenue in New York. But at the core, there probably was more similarities than dissimilarities, where, you know, this just sort of ruthless intent that I think was a hallmark probably of the early 20th century, late 19th century, when the country was developing and people saw opportunities, probably not unlike the dawn of the digital age and, you know, what we're living through now with Bitcoin and things like that, where most people will not be able to get it. A few will, and some will pay a high price to get it. And one of those people was Cassie Chadwick.
What did the press make of her?
You know, the press had a funny relationship with her because she was a good interview, and she would sit down, like, hear one of her first interviews when she's arrested and she's taken to the Tombs in New York to be put in jail. She gave an interview in the warden's office. And, you know, she's very chatty with them. And they would ask her about Andrew Carnegie. And she'd say, well, I can't really say anything about that. And she'd have a little smile on her face. And so she was, you know, she was great press for them. There was a little book that came out during this time. I actually managed to get a copy of it, and it sold for like a quarter. And it was basically nothing. It was just this little book of what they knew about her to this point. And people bought it like mad. And, you know, the amount of articles, I mean, it was a media juggernaut. I mean, it's just, I couldn't even get through all. I mean, there's just hundreds, if not thousands, of these articles on her. And it's why? Because it's sex, it's money, it's this tintillating idea that, you know, there might be this big cover up from Carnegie, who was regarded as a god at this time. And so, and also Cassie understood media. She understood the power of media. And so she tried as much as she could to sort of forge a picture of herself. And it worked right up to the point where she was convicted. And, you know, take Beckworth. Beckworth went to see her. This is the banker whose bank failed and he died. He went to see her in jail and before the trial. And he went up there with his wife and he talked to her and he said to her, you know, I still believe you are who you say you are and that you will, you know, make all this right. And what he's saying is he could not give up the idea that she was, in fact, this very wealthy woman who he had lent not only the bank's money to, but his own, and that she would really come through for him. And by the way, people said about Cassie Chadwick, well, she had these hypnotic eyes that were very strange. And a lot of people actually accused her of hypnotizing people, hypnotizing bankers and such like that. But she must have had this aura because Ira Reynolds, of the Wade Park Bank, who signed the little package and said it was worth $5 million. So when they opened it, there was nothing in it but some old bonds and things like that. He too lent her his own money. And when he was in the trial, when, you know, they had a deposition for him, he said, you know, I still think that she will pay it back. I mean, it was crazy. But, you know, she had this ability to make people think that, you know, she was who she said she was. She was the great Cassie Chadwick, who was immensely wealthy and was going to inherit the money from Andrew Carnegie.
Well, the Elizabeth Holmes of the world truly do stand on the shoulders of giants, because I hear so many similarities there. After her conviction, what happens to her? And does she leave any legacy in the American consciousness, or does she mostly disappear?
Actually, so she gets sentenced to 11 years. Actually, it was 10 years. And she immediately falls ill, goes back to the prison she was in the 1890s when she got sent there for forgery. And her prison work was one of darning the male prisoner's shirts. And that's what she did every day. And she quickly became very ill, couldn't see. She was deaf, by the way, very much in one ear. In fact, in the trial, when they said she was guilty, she thought she got off. And her lawyer had to turn to her and say, no, Miss Chadwick, they found you guilty, because she really couldn't hear very well at all. So she dies about 2.5 years into her sentence. And, you know, her legacy, you know, is one of, you know, she lived on. I mean, in terms of, you know, this strange story of the Gilded Age, it kept popping up and up and up, you know, not unlike Ponzi. I mean, Ponzi scheme, we know, because Ponzi just was in the 20s and, you know, he's sort of associated with the F. Scott Fitzgerald era. And so that became much more culturally a sort of touchstone. But Cassie Chadwick, you know, has come up repeatedly over the years. And again, because I looked through all the newspaper articles, you know, the Smithsonian Magazine ran a piece on her in 2014. And just through the 1960s, 1970s, the 30s, 40s, she would resurface. And so to bet you don't know this, and you know, this con woman, what kind of legacy is that? I think you attach her to the, and you know, in my book, I go through a lot of the events of the Gilded Age that are going on in America, you know, from the Statue of Liberty being built to the Brooklyn Bridge to all this expansion. So she's really, you have to look at her in the context of that time, you know, that she was a product of, yes, she came as sort of built-in con woman, if you will, but she also walked into a country that was on the make at that time, with incredible opportunity, incredible greed, corruption, just expanding wealth. I mean, America was basically becoming who she would be, the superpower. But, you know, her birthing pains, if you will, were vast. And so you had, you know, all these people working in the foundries and such, children and on the child labor laws, and a lot of people dying and working 6-hour days, 10-hour days, 6 days a week. So, you know, it was, everything was wide open after the Civil War. And I love bookending it with the Titanic, you know, in 1912, April 14th, because, you know, one reason people are so fascinated with Titanic is because it was the Gilded Age going down into the ocean, you know, all that wealth and all that. And after Titanic, it seems like the 20th century moves in all its carnage, and pretty much the Gilded Age was over.
What do you think her story says about the Gilded Age, for both positive and negative? We touched on some of the negative aspects, and that's easy to suss out, that there's a weaponization of these old world values that are hijacked in order to support greed and taking advantage of people. But I wonder if there are positive things we could say about her, that perhaps if circumstances had worked differently and maybe she had married a legitimately wealthy man, she could have gone legitimate. And sort of like a, I don't know, Empress Theodora, the Byzantine Empire, who came from a lowly circus performer background, but marries Justinian, moves into a position of wealth and prestige, and in her own right, as a political ruler, is very tactful, does a lot to create social order. So I don't know. I mean, what can we say about her? What does she say about the Gilded Age, both positively and negatively?
Well, I think one of the things we could say, first of all, is that if she was a woman, at a time when women were relegated to, you know, being a secretary at best, a teacher, but mostly they were all stuck at home, she did not have the vote. This is a time when women wore corsets with the whalebone in it, which nearly killed them. And yet, this woman of no education, no meaningful support, no in into society, managed, in this way, it's a Horatio Alger story, managed to bootstrap her way up through society to the top rung, beat the 1% at their own game. And she did beat them, even though all these bankers thought, and they were in on it too. I mean, she really got left holding the bag. They killed her with high interest rates. They got $30,000 payoffs, you know, it's kickbacks for from these loans. She beat them at their own game, playing on their own greed, their own thoughts that they could get this Carnegie money. And she did it over and over and over. So this woman who really, at a time when America had given women no rights at all, went to the very top and beat all the players at their own game, you know, or if you will, she came to the poker table with nothing and left with all the other players' wallets. And I don't know if that means she was a brilliant woman or she had a brilliant con. I think it's for the readers probably to decide.
It's amazing how much those two run together in this time period. So, I mean, this is a fascinating era. And I think that your story shows the excesses and contradictions, but in many ways, the heart of what the Gilded Age is. And for listeners who want to get into the story more, the name of your book is Greed in the Gilded Age, The Brilliant Con of Cassie Chadwick. Bill, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
All right, that is all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes for this and all my other episodes and include sources, maps, or other relevant information, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. Parthenon is the name of the podcast network that History Unplugged is a part of, along with other great history shows like James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. This really helps the show grow. The second thing is to join our membership program on Patreon. And if you do so, you can get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog of the show, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening and see you next time.